Good evening, everyone. Good to see you all here this evening. We're on page number 34 in the lesson book, lesson 12 of the book, but Romans chapter 11. We'll begin chapter 11 tonight, our discussion. We're going to try to cover the first 10 verses tonight of this chapter. I think we can get there, maybe. This, as you probably have realized in working the lesson, this is probably a little more challenging than some of the others we've had. And we're going to be that way for probably about three or four chapters. Because Romans is deep. It is deep. It is not, this is what I consider one of Paul's greatest works as far as writing goes. Because there's such strong arguments and things that cannot be argued against once understood. And as the theme of the book goes on, he's declaring God's righteousness. It's what he's doing. He's making the argument, the case that God, for God's righteousness and the way of God is better. As our custom has been, let us read the first 10 verses of the chapter before we begin our discussion. Does anyone want to volunteer to read?
Jenny does a good job.
I can't, Johnny. You're going to have to do it tonight. I went to the dentist today.
Y'all made it do it?
Yes, go right ahead.
Right. Okay, well, King James or New King James?
Doesn't matter to me.
God forbid, for I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God hath not cast away his people which he foreknew. What was it? Would ye not that what the scripture saith of Elias? How he made intercession to God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets and dig down thine altars. And I am left alone, and they seek my life. But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And if by grace, then is it no more works. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. But if it be of works, then is it no more grace? Otherwise, work is no more work. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded. According as it is written, God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear, unto this day. And David saith, let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see and bow down their back our way.
All right. Thank you for reading that. Question number one, or thought discussion questions on page 34, says, why did Paul ask the question with which chapter 11 begins? And that question, has God cast away his people?
Why did he ask that?
Yep, that's the question.
If we look at Paul's writings on several occasions, he asked a rhetorical question with an obvious answer.
And really what I mean is that the people cast away him away.
For example, when he was Greek and they had all the other unknown altars, and when he said, asked about that, the unknown God. And that's kind of like this. He's wanting them to understand God did not cast them away, they cast God away.
Yep. And he is still interested in them. The argument he makes in this chapter about being grafted in, that the others being grafted and so forth, God hasn't cast away his people, and so he's fixing to give the proof that God is still interested in his people, Israel, interested in them to come to him through grace by faith, or by faith through grace, whichever way you want to look at it, I guess. But he makes that argument in this, and begins to make it in this chapter. Question, or second part of this question is, how is Paul proof that God has not rejected all Jews?
He gives his lineage.
Gives his lineage to prove that he is a Jew, yep. And hadn't rejected him, right? Paul has not been rejected. So there's your proof. He himself is saying, I am the proof. That God has not rejected his people, or his people has not accepted of him. One of the things that I want us to notice as we go through this is he seems to split it up. You got two sets of people as far as the Israelites go. The ones that believe and the ones who don't believe. If you can get that straight in your head, some of this makes a little more sense. He's talking about two groups, the ones that believe and the ones who don't believe. God's going to reject the ones who don't believe, but he finds grace to extend to those who will believe. What is the, as far as the Jews is concerned, even in that day and time, what did they believe concerning Jesus Christ?
They were looking for an earthly king, and they were basically trying to put him in that peg hole. And if you read, I believe it's the first chapter of John, they were looking, those that were studying the scriptures was looking for Christ. They didn't know exactly how he was going to be, but they were looking for it because he had been foretold by the prophets.
And we still had the group of Jews, which was the greater part, that was rejecting him. If you remember in our study in the book of Acts, especially when we get over to where Paul was going before Felix and Festus and getting in Rome on that trip to Rome to Caesar, many times in that span of time that we was reading about and studying about, Paul would give them evidences, tell them about events, like remember what you saw, to where they could not reject that was not the Christ. Or that they would try to reject, but they couldn't reject it because the proof was there. And then they still had eyewitness proof. And we don't have eyewitness proof, and John tells us in his writing in the book of John that blessed are those who believe who have not seen. So he was like, it's a matter of a strong faith for us today because we haven't seen and we have no witnesses that are alive. The witnesses we have are all written. And what we observe, you know, we can, talking about Christ, not God. God we can observe and figure out that he was here. We see the evidence left behind by Christ, which makes it a faith-based belief in him. These folks had eyewitnesses. Some may have even, or had opportunity to see, because they would have been very young when Christ was crucified. And yet they still rejected, they still refused to believe because they were looking for something else. If you remember, the apostles had a little trouble with it too for a period of time. Because you remember what Jesus told them? My kingdom is not of
this world.
He was playing with them, told them, it's not of this world. So they had a little trouble with it in the beginning, understand that concept. And it was because of the false teachings of the Jews. That's why they had trouble with it. It took me a few years to figure that out, that was the problem. Because remember, the Jews were teaching things that were not right according to the law of Moses. And they confused a lot of people trying to do what they thought they were teaching was correct, which was the doctrines of men more than the doctrines of God.
Next week, the first talking about the Jews having zeal, but not according to knowledge.
Yep. That points it out. Question number two says, who are the people which God foreknew?
Christians.
Yep, the Christians. He foreknew they were in the future. At the time the Israelites were, the Israelites, his race, was chosen of God, the Christians were in the future. Second part of this is, what was Paul's purpose in using the example of Elijah?
Elijah, they were worshiping Baal. And because they were, he presumed that he was the only one left. And they were trying to kill him. They were trying to chase him down and kill him. And that point is pointed out in his prayer to God, that he was saying that, hey, I'm the only one left. And God told him that there were 7,000 that hadn't bowed their knee.
This story is one of my favorites in the Old Testament about Elijah.
I just read that today because in my Bible study I've been doing Old Testament, so it's like 1 Kings 19.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was, and then it was in this. It just went along together. I know, that's why I mentioned.
Anyway, you have Elijah. Lord tells him what he needs to do. He goes and does it. He confronts Ahab. He has what I call the mountaintop experience, where Elijah. This is what I don't understand. But I don't, on one hand, and on the other hand, I say, well, I guess it kind of makes sense, because you have Elijah having what we call the mountaintop experience. He takes on the prophets of Baal, and it was what about, we know that they killed 400, about 400, and so that probably indicates that there was a few hundred up there on the mountain. Builds the altar. And they build the altar, and they cry, "Oh, Baal, hear us," it says, "from morning till lunchtime." So he goes, you need to cry louder, because he can't hear you. Maybe he's deaf. Maybe he's hard of hearing. And that's where, to me, the comedy begins. And then perhaps he's relieving himself. He's going to the bathroom. So perhaps he's relieving himself. So you see, kind of make fun of him a little bit. So what's their reaction?
They cut themselves.
they go harder on it.
Yeah.
They jumped, said, leap. They leaped on the altar. They cut themselves. They done all kinds of stuff to get Baal's attention. Then what is he telling them a little bit more? Maybe he's on a journey.
Yeah.
Maybe he went on vacation, as we'd say. The altar he builds. He puts the sacrifice on it. He digs a ditch around it, and it tells us the size of it, how much it holds. He puts basically 2 barrels of water on it, runs down the altar, fills the trench around it. Thing is soaking wet. He prays to God one time. Fire comes down from heaven, consumes the sacrifice, consumes the altar, licks. Yep, laps up the water. And I'm just thinking, if you were witnessing this, how much greater, it's like, how much of a more of a spiritual high could you have? You just took on a big chunk of the king and queen's prophets to the false god. You just proved he doesn't exist. And you prayed one time and God answered your prayer immediately. I think I'd be a little excited, wouldn't you? He's excited for about this long, about this much, just a wee bit. And Jezebel says, "I'm going to kill you." I don't know why he believed her after that experience, but he did. So So that's when he goes down and to the brook and a little cave, and he hides out. And reasons with, and then God lets him sulk for a little while. And then that's where we see what we read, or a piece of what we read tonight. After God answers him, does God uses nature. If you go back and look at that story, God revealed himself to him the same way he does to us today, through nature. Well, it had an earthquake, a whirlwind, some like there was one or two other things, and then the dead of quiet. Quiet. It was quiet.
But it's the same thing today. How many of us feel like we're alone when we hear about abortion, we hear about all other things that are going on, hear about those things, and we feel like, hey, I've been left alone to be against that. I'm the only one that's against it.
Right, and we're not.
Which is the purpose,
purpose
to use an example, right?
Yep. Purpose, that's you got it. That's why I use that example. Because they understood. Remember who he's speaking to? The people who would have known the law, or at least would have read it. They would have read about Elijah. They would have read this story. They would have perhaps known a lot about this story. And yet the encouragement is given, just as God asked him, "You're not alone. I have 7,000 followers in the city. Get up and go do what I want you to do." So he forced him out of his stupor and got him to go. God has not forgotten about his people. He has not left his people. And there's always a remnant. There's always a number there. And we gotta remember that. He is reminding them of this. God has not forgotten his people.
You know, and I forget the verse, but it came to mind that talks about fire purifies.
Yep, the refiner's fire.
And yeah. So what happens is, anytime that there's a hard event, it refines or separates those that put their faith in God from those that don't.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's what he's explaining. They're being divided from the believer and unbeliever. It's being divided. We got to remember that we may think we're alone. We're not alone. God, at a minimum, God Christ and the Spirit is with us. That's the minimum, but it's going to be more than that. It's going to be more than we think. I think about the, you know, right now they tell us where the largest number of members of the church are. Which country do you believe it is? It may surprise some of you. Nope. China. That's what they tell us. China has the largest number at the moment, members of the church, and they're all underground. They're not out in the open. It's an underground movement because of the oppression, religious oppression, of the CCP or the Chinese government. Do you think those people could feel alone? They might. Especially in small numbers and handfuls here and there, they might feel they're alone, but they're not. There's literally millions of people that have not bowed the knee to Baal. So there's some words of encouragement we can find in that, I believe. Question number 3, I believe that's where we are. What does remnant mean?
Those that are left.
Those are left. You might define it as a number, not a defined number, but a number of people. The next question is found in verse 5, that reference. What was the remnant that remained?
He's talking about those that remained faithful.
Those that remained faithful. Those that were justified by faith. That's who he's talking about. That's the remnant that remained. Yes. And that's who remained. He's trying to encourage them and trying to pull them over to the good side. Question 4 says, explain, and if by grace, then it is no more of works.
We have to It's unmerited favor, which means it's something that's given to you. Works means something that you earn. We don't earn our salvation. It's unmerited, by unmerited favor.
It's God's initiative without man's part or man's work to do it. That's the way John Stott put it in his book. God's initiative excludes ours, and I thought that was a pretty good way to look at it. We know, if it's by grace, then it is no more of works. Is that saying that we don't do anything? No, it's not saying that. It's saying that to receive the gift was not anything that you had done. It was a work of God. It was a work of God, not a work of man. And then the next part of the question is, but if it be of works, then it is no more grace. So what is that? How do you explain that?
If we work and earn it, it's not unmerited favor.
That's right. You can't do anything to earn it. This concept, we talked about it a few chapters back in light of a little bit different context. But in the world we live in today, probably the ones who discuss this ad nauseum is probably Southern Baptist. They write and talk about this all the time, but they take it a step further and say there's absolutely, you don't do anything, which I think is taking a step too far. It's not saying that you do nothing. It's not saying that you do things to earn. But we know that in order to be saved, there's conditions to be met, right? We have to do something to be able to qualify for the free gift. As far as us living a life that demands that we be given grace, we can't do it. There's no way. If it wasn't a gift, we couldn't get it because we can't be good enough. Who has not sinned? The only one we know to walk this earth besides God himself was Jesus. Jesus Christ. And everything else is fallen, right? We're living a fallen creation. We live amongst fallen people, including ourselves. And so we have to have grace in order to obtain salvation. Otherwise, there'd be no way we could do it because there's nothing we can do to earn it. And I think he's reminding them of this with that verse, or with that saying. Yes, sir.
You could think of it a little bit like this, that the time clock, you punch that time clock and you're expecting to get a check at the end of it. Okay? From time to time, a company will give people bonuses. They don't have to pay them. They don't have to give that bonus. Because to some extent, you don't earn it. It's a gift. And it doesn't matter whether or not you're the most efficient worker or the least efficient worker, you still get a bonus. And that's kind of like unmerited favor. It's a favor that's given to you, and it's something that you haven't earned by punching the time clock.
I'm reminded of when Jesus was talking about unworthy servants. It may be titled in your New Testaments in Luke chapter 17. Was it verse 8? Verse number 10. So also when you have done all that you were commanded, you did it all, everything you've done, say, we are unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty, what was expected. It's kind of a sobering thought in a way that when we, and kind of to me proves the point he's pointing out here. We can't do it on our own. When we've done it perfectly, start to finish, we've only done what's expected. That's kind of a humbling statement, isn't it, to think about. At the same time, don't let it get us down. Don't let us discourage us. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Like I've said many times, Christianity is it's a proactive religion. It's a proactive state. It's not an inactive state. We're always to be about the master's business. We're always to be doing things as long as we have breath within us. Because what is our purpose? To serve God, according to Ecclesiastes. Our purpose is to serve God. So we have to do that as long as we have breath within us. Find some way to be of service.
Oh, this is just like taking it to us. But, you know, kind of ran into this. Because, you know, when we were growing up, and I think it's like our age group here. When we were growing up, there were certain things you were supposed to do. I mean, this was your chores and you did them. And back in those days, they never said, you know, they just expected it. Nobody, you know, it wasn't on any of this other stuff. The only time you ever heard the other stuff was, why didn't you collect the eggs today? Or why didn't you do this?
Yeah.
And you didn't expect to get paid for it either.
No, you didn't expect to. Right. It was expected. And now, the attitude, and why I'm bringing this up is like, because the schools and everything, is what they're doing now is if you do anything, you know, they brag on you and everything. They even give you, if you're in a little baseball team, you know, and you don't win the game, you get a plaque.
Yeah, participation trophy. Yep.
Yes. And, you know, but I think the reason we were more like that than maybe others is because it's like what you're saying. You know, when we were growing up, that I think they realized that this is just expected of you. You do that.
That was your contribution to the family.
Yes. Right.
That was your contribution to the family.
There was an old saying too that nobody did. And that was spare the rod, spoil the child.
Yep. Yeah.
But they wasn't even kind of talking back. I mean, it's big.
Right.
That's a good way to get a hand across the mouth right there. It was talk back. We picked up hay, we done all that stuff. Never thought about getting paid for it. That never entered my mind. Because we were doing what we thought was expected of us.
Never thought about saying no. Or anything. We just like, okay, time, let's get up, let's go do the, you know, strip tobacco, let's go do this, let's go do that.
Yeah, as different mode of thinking.
There was stuff I didn't grow up on a farm, but you know, I had.
Well, I'm sure you can
do laundry and hang out the clothes.
Yeah.
Other stuff.
Right.
Yep.
There was a lady lived at the corner of East Oakland Road down there. And her husband died.
Miss Kirby?
Is that?
Was it Miss Kirby? No. That was Mill Road.
It was down at the corner of Mill Road. Anyway, her husband died and everything, and she had hay to get up, and I remember there was a bunch from here at Bethel. Went down there to help get up the hay, and there was a bunch of us down there that lived down there was going to help get up the hay and everything. And Daddy couldn't go, so he hired somebody to go in his place. And so he told me I need to go over and help get up the hay. And I asked him, was I going to get paid too? And you know, and he gave me an answer that has stayed with me all my life. There's some things that are better than getting paid. This is it.
Yeah, Daddy worked on Saturday, and there's a couple times I got sent in his place for stuff like that. I can remember we built a couple of houses for people. You know, somebody had a house burn, and they didn't have the money to go get a carpenter or whatever. So church people got together, built them a house. You know, we've done that for two people that I can remember, and helping out with that as a wee lad. So yeah, those are things that built a community too. That's why you had a community. It was of necessity. And now we wouldn't do that. Nobody would think to do that. They wouldn't, oh, poor pitiful you, here's you some money. You know, throw some money at it and walk off instead of putting the manual labor into it. That's the part of our culture that we have sadly lost. I talk about, Mama's probably getting tired of me talking about it, but But you know, I like to see different ones of you that go to these gospel meetings. I love seeing you there because that's supporting the preaching of the gospel. That used to be part of our culture. Big part of our culture, American culture. It's not, it's dying out. It's not as much anymore. You know, things that were good, we supported. You know, the community supported. And we don't see that as much anymore. And I'm saddened that it's gotten to that point, that we're losing that part of our culture, because that's what made us what we are.
Well, I think you said something one time that just hit home, like if we want them to come visit us,
yep,
we need to go visit them.
Yep.
Showing interest.
Yep. You made the statement, everybody knows you. Well, in the church circuit, that's about right, because of what you're talking about. We try to hit everybody.
Well, I said everybody knows
you. Yeah. Well, that's what did I say it wrong? That's what I meant to say.
Well, you were saying, I don't know.
Okay.
But,
I just wanted to make sure it was understood that it was you.
Yeah.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even my girlfriend called me from the morning, and said, who is this?
Question number 5 is, what was Israel, fleshly Israel, seeking? Earthly king. And why had they not attained it?
Because that wasn't in God's plan.
Because it wasn't in God's plan. And also you could look at it from the flip side. They could not obtain it because they were blinded, or in other translations it's going to say that instead of blinded, they were hardened. Hardened to heart. We go back to the Old Testament again, back to Pharaoh. His heart was hardened. The reason his heart was hardened is because of Moses, God sending Moses and Aaron. That's what hardened his heart. They were doing what God had them to do, and he didn't want to have anything to do with it, it seemed. He would lie to them, or, you know, how many times did he say, I'll let the people go? Then they'd all get ready to go, and they said, nope, you're not going. Never mind. Then God bring another plague on him and on the nation. Then they'd do the same thing. And then finally, the last one, the one that hardened his heart the most, that was the last one, the last plague, it took the firstborn out of Egypt. Took the firstborn. It was like, you could kind of reads in the scripture like he's, feathers fell, hot water was poured on him. All right, you can take them to go worship. This time they made an exodus. And then what did he do?
Chased
them. Hardened his heart even more and chased them. He went harder. He went in harder. That's what he done to his own destruction, the destruction of the army. Where they're laying, you know, still to this day, there's pieces and parts laying in the bottom of the sea that parted. And what I love is a few years ago when they sent some divers down there, they found a lot of that stuff. Like, wow, so they found chariots with one wheel missing off of them. Because what did God do to the chariots? Made the wheels fall off. And so it's all proven. I mean, it's proven to be true. So that's not, I mean, you can, if you were to one of those divers and went down there, it's no longer a matter of faith, is it? Because it's sight. You can see what happened. Anyway, back to this. They missed it because they hardened their hearts. They refused to see what was before them. They were blinded. Next part is, why had the election obtained it?
They believed in Christ.
Yep, it came. They believed, and it came through faith. That's why they got it. And the next part is, why had the election? Wait a minute, we just did that. Number 6. Who are the rest that were blinded?
It's the ones that didn't accept Christ.
Ones that didn't believe. So you're starting to see now, they're talking about two groups of people here at this point. Believers and non-believers of the Jews. They didn't believe God or Christ by faith. They just refused to do it. It says, how were they blinded? Yeah, just through their disbelief. What was that?
Seven of delusion.
Sent him an illusion. Who was the delusion?
Really does send those illusions, or does God let some extra time?
Well, who is the delusion?
He does Satan.
Jesus.
What?
The sending of Christ was the strong delusion. They refused to believe because he came. It caused some to harden their hearts. It caused some to go hard against God. Others, it softened their hearts, and they accepted Christ as who he is.
If you read, he was not. They were looking for an earthly king because the Romans were their conquerors. And they were looking for somebody to lead them against Rome, to relieve them of the misery of the Roman bondage, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a delusion.
Question number 7, and I think we'll stop at this question when we answer it. It says, explain verses 9 and 10. Verse 9 and 10 says, and David says, let their table be made a snare, and a trap, and a stumbling block, and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see, and bow down their back alway. So if you read it in a different translation, ESV, it says, let their table become a snare and a trap, a stumbling block and retribution for them, and let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see, and bend their backs forever. What do you think about that?
We know what a stumbling block is. It's something that you trip, just like it's something that would be in their path that they would trip and fall over as they were walking along. And that's what happens today, or happens when people study the Bible. They don't study it to understand what God wants them to do. They study it to find things that confirms what they want it to say. And that's basically what they were doing. They were trying to make God's will their will, or their will God's will, I guess is a better way to say it.
I want to read to you out of John Stott's book, from page 294. Says the second quotation, verse 9, comes from Psalm 69, which portrays a righteous person's experience of persecution. Jesus applied it to himself when he said, they hated me without a reason. And the early Christians, therefore quickly identified it as messianic. This victim of unprovoked hostility prays both that God will vindicate him, and that God will just judgment will fall upon his enemies. Because of the messianic nature of the psalm, Paul is able to reverse its application. Instead of Israel being persecuted, she has become, in her rejection of Christ, the persecutor. And then this is what the psalmist prayed, and then we see the quotation. And then he says, this imagery is not easy to interpret, but their table seems to be a symbol of security, well-being, and community, which are enjoyed at home, and which somehow can be turned into the opposite, becoming a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a retribution for them. The reference to their backs being bent forever is also obscure, although the bending or the bent back is normally a picture of carrying a heavy load. Whether this is the case of grief, fear, or oppression. So this is his take on that. That passage. I thought it was interesting that he was saying that them becoming the oppressor because of their unbelief is what made it the trap and the snare. I said, no, that kind of makes sense. You had something to say?
So when it says let their table be made a snare, is that like I would rather stay home and eat dinner than come to church? my table, at my table, something like that.
I haven't thought about it that way, but... It's comfortable to do it. It's more comfortable to sit around the table at home.
Right.
It's the security idea, the issue, this is where I would rather be.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like you saying, take that comfort away so they'll be provoked to get out and...
do something.
Yeah.
Stumbling block, it could also be the Jews added to and took away, and they required certain things so far as what they ate, their hands had to be washed, all this. It became a stumbling block to them because they couldn't actually serve God for tripping over their own
righteousness, so to speak.
Speak for their own laws and things.
Yeah. Yep, because if you remember, there was an occasion where Jesus was asked, why do your disciples not wash their hands before they eat? That was one of the Jewish laws. It was not part of the Old Testament, but they taught it as if it were. There's several of those laws. If you go back to Matthew 23, you can learn about. Jesus criticizes them for it, for doing this and for making this an issue like that.
And verse 10, where it says, let their eyes be darkened, that they may not see and bow down their back away. So that could be like, you know, people that just work so much. I mean, you know, we're on computers, we need glasses, you know, and then you're out working, and you just work yourself into the ground for maybe money or something. Does that apply there?
I can see that, but it tying it back into the first verse, or the verse number 9, I was kind of thinking about what he was talking about. Or tying it back to verse number 7. Why were they blinded? Because of disbelief.
Okay.
Why were they blinded? Why was it a snare? Why was Jesus a snare, a stumbling block, and offensive to them? Because they didn't believe. And that caused them to be blind because their mind was made up. They were not open-minded. You've met people like that, right? When they come to you to tell you what they're going to tell you, they're not going to listen. They're not going to say anything other than what they're blinded to see and will not change.
He did,
didn't he? Put on the eye salve, didn't he? So that you can see. Soften it up. Any other comments, questions? If not, we'll end right here. It's a good stopping place, and we'll pick up with verse number 11 next week.